Hey everyone, welcome to Gods of Eden. Today's guest is Oliver Seligman. As you learn in the episode, I'm incredibly grateful for Ollie's patience with some of the early technical difficulties. But even with that, we have this really, really beautiful conversation. And a huge reason for that is Ollie has this just lovely, not only energy and just sense of being, but I really appreciated his ability to verbalize where he was during the time, whilst also being able to differentiate and speak about how he feels now, kind of removed from some of the challenges he's been presented in his life. One of those being, which you're going to be able to see in the title of the episode, Ollie was diagnosed with bipolar in his teenage years, and he speaks a lot about how that's impacted his journey over, well, prolonged period of time, and the challenges that, once again, that's presented. But we talk about the mindset of befriending challenges rather than fighting them. Ollie talks about, he has this beautiful answer on happiness that really resonated with me at the time, and once again resonates with me in this process of editing. And yeah, Ollie's just a really, really nice, genuine dude, and I think it's really apparent in the episode. So please check the show notes so you can keep in contact with Ollie. And yeah, I just can't wait to give you guys this episode and for more and more people to learn about Ollie's journey. So without further ado, 3, 2, 1, let's go. Hey Ollie, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. I'll be fully transparent with people. My laptop started freaking out, so this is second round to go. Fortunately, we weren't too far in, and you have got the patience of an angel, so thank you once again.
Oh, you're welcome. Very welcome. I think you're keeping your cool very well.
It's fine. Question number one. Can you please give me and the listeners a song that makes you happy or reminds you of a good memory?
Well, the reason I'm going to pick this song is because whenever I play it, particularly if I put it on loud and I close my eyes, it's like the whole song just possesses me. It just takes me over and it just lifts me up slowly, 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 and gets me more and more excited and intense and gives me this incredible experience of being absolutely alive and at one with the music. And I think a lot of people have this experience because it's quite a popular song, and it's called Insomnia by Faithless.
Oh, I love it. It is such a great song, and I completely concur with how if you can play it loud, especially if it's like a gym workout or like an immersive experience, it's such a great song.
Yeah, amazing. Absolutely amazing. I don't know how they did that. Amazing.
And that is going to live on the Gods of Eden soundtrack playlist, which is on Spotify. And another fantastic contribution. I can't thank you enough for that alone. So thank you, Ollie. I appreciate it.
Well, I got lucky because I was listening to some of your other podcasts and I saw that you asked everyone that question. So I had a good think about it.
Oh, I would be the exact same. That's the thing. The first time I ever asked it, I think it was the beginning of season 2. The person was like, yeah, can you give me like a couple minutes to think? I wasn't prepared. So ever since, like we spoke before the recording, I'm like, let me give the person like a kind of a running start, given the question before, have a quick ponder. But very luckily with your research and kind of familiarity with Gods of Eden, you already had the answer, which is awesome. So thank you.
You're welcome.
First question, 1B. What was a young Ollie like growing up? Not key reason I asked, but the reason it's almost the question that feels even more personal to you, whereas I would usually ask it to other people, is that today we'll get into kind of your experience with bipolar, what that's led to, and all the amazing work that you've done. But something I'm very conscious of is what was Ollie like growing up, but also in the context of, did you see yourself having any signs as a young Ollie prior to your diagnosis that maybe would have indicated that potentially there would have been a mental health battle that you may face later on?
Well, I guess it depends on who you asked You know, if you ask me, I'm incredibly biased, and I'm going to give you very, very good opinion of what I was like. My answer could be something like, I was a child prodigy, grade eight in three or four different instruments. But if you ask anyone else that I meet, they would say that I was generally good fun and that I enjoyed people's company. I was an extrovert. I enjoyed sort of showing off to all the adults and having fun with other kids my age, but also that I was very high strung and had a tendency to be pretty nervous. I was, I was very much a mummy's boy when I was little. I always sort of felt safest around my mum or my dad. And I think a lot of the time I did experience a lot of nervousness and a kind of an inability to relax that very few other people my age seemed to have. So I think when I was distracted, you know, when I was sort of building castles or climbing trees or all these kind of outdoor sort of sporty things that I really enjoyed, I think I was probably as happy as anyone. But I think I really had a tendency to sort of worry and think about things. I actually remember, and this might be experience that a lot of your listeners have, but I remember for years being very, very scared about nuclear holocaust, because it was very much kind of in the air at that stage. You know, there was a friction between the East and the West, and it was kind of on the news and stuff. And I obviously never watched the news, but there was just this kind of, I sort of had this sense of impending doom and this sense that life was very unsafe, that I was kind of a nervous person. And then all of a sudden I would get into a situation that I really enjoyed or felt comfortable in, and I'd kind of be the life and the soul of the party.
Yeah, so intriguing. Because we spoke about it before, but I think I look back at like who I was, I think more so in my teenage years, like when you're really forming like your personality. And I was always someone that was wildly introverted as a kid. I was an only child. So, and I was a bit of a nerd in terms of I'd come home and just play PlayStation. Like I was very content with that. Although I would like play football with kids on my street and certain other bits. But like my real peace was like my bedroom. I was like, anybody that knew me growing up, like that was it. I'd go in my bedroom, door shut, PlayStation, music. And I was always a bit of a daydreamer too. But I do feel like it would indicate like, I guess, whether they're personality traits or mental health traits, like that I end up having to work through and kind of readjust. But something with me especially is that I have real trouble verbalizing like whether I'm in trouble or in pain or in anything. And I think it's something that was very, that I look back as a child and like that was very much how I was inclined then as well, that there wasn't a symbolic, you know, individual massive moment where that changed. But so when I kind of was learning about your story, it was something I was really intrigued by, the idea of, I wonder what you would have been like as a child and whether there was any kind of signs in that sense. But something I did want to ask was your experience of your diagnosis and kind of your reaction around it at the time, this idea of to go through something so significantly life-changing at such a young age. Like, how did you manage it at that time?
Yeah, I don't think I really did manage it. I think, and this is probably a lot of people's experience with many different kind of huge shocks that you have when you're, you know, under 25 or under 30 or whatever. And it was almost like this whole thing just happened to me and it knocked me sideways. And I didn't really know sort of how to deal with it. And the interesting thing with mental illness or with bipolar, which is kind of my area of experience, the interesting thing is that something that affects you mentally, it doesn't just affect your mind, it affects everything, because our mind is how we interact with the world. So if someone, as you know, if someone's depressed, then everything in their life tends to be unlucky. It tends to be a source of suffering. The things that flowed beforehand stop flowing. The relationships that were really fun and nurturing and alive, they sort of start to fade, or they just become full of more conflict, more difficulties. You know, it's a bit like someone with a mental illness. It's a bit like if you sort of just expect, well, you know, someone's depressed, so if they can sort of deal with their depression, then at least they can get on with the rest of their life. But someone who's depressed can't get on with the rest of their life because all of the mechanisms to do that are ill. And so it would be a bit like saying to someone with a broken leg, come on, mate, you can run a marathon. And they go, I've got a broken leg. I can't run a marathon. No, come on, just, you know, spin it up. You can do it. It'll be fine. And so I think with me, with mental illness, I suddenly went from this guy who probably over a few years or at least for a few months had been going kind of steadily more mad, you know, steadily more manic, you know, more stressed, more thoughts in my mind, more negativity, more inability to relax. And that had kind of been going for a long time. And then suddenly it all kind of crescendos with ending up thinking that, you know, I've raped a girl and I've been arrested and I've been put in a police station that's disguised as a mental hospital. And then being given some very strong kind of downers, which took me further down than anyone would have intended. And then having to deal with this incredibly horrible sort of medication-induced depression. And then so this sort of goes on. And then I guess after a few weeks in the mental hospital, I received a lot of love from my parents, from the staff, and I was on some antidepressants. And I started to come back. And I got to a place where I was well enough to be, you know, released, to be sent home. But that was where, in theory, I would have started sort of coming to terms with the fact that I had bipolar, you know, because I was diagnosed by then and it was very, very apparent that, you know, things were not right. But at that time, all I wanted to do was just get on with my life and get back to where I thought I should be. And, you know, I was 17 and my friends were all kind of 17, 18, going either to university or getting jobs or going traveling, whatever they were doing. And everything had been kind of stopped in my life. And I didn't know if I could trust my own nervous system. You know, I didn't know if I could go to London because maybe I'll go mad. I didn't know if I could go to university because maybe it won't work. You know, it's like everything became this huge, confusing sort of mystery. And it was almost like, in some ways, it was almost like having to reset my life and start again. But I didn't have the sort of the age and the wisdom to kind of know that's what I should do. So instead, I kind of just pushed everything behind me as quickly as I could. I didn't really address bipolar at all. I didn't read anything about it. I didn't really learn anything about it other than what my psychiatrist told me. I was lucky I had a great psychiatrist, but they can only do so much. And basically, I just thought, right, I'm just going to live the best life I can. I'm just going to crack on. And if I take the medication, I'll be fine. And that was me for the next basically 15, 20 years.
Just so many different avenues and kind of trails that my mind goes to off that answer. It's a sign of an incredible answer. I'm really grateful for it. I will stick on the chronological side of things. So you do come out of hospital and you do end up going to university. So just like you said, you've given like a mini preview to even the question I want to ask, which is how did you find adjusting to university? And also how was your like early experiences of, I imagine like finding your balance and fitting again with life at a time where seemingly a lot's changing. For me, it was, I guess I'm somewhat personalizing that and kind of hoping that it's the common experience, but the idea of, I found in my experience that time of 18 and moving away for university, like it felt like so much was, like even for me, I felt like finding my feet was challenging. So how did you find that transition of university and how were those early days for you when you were making your way up to the land of the Geordies and going as well, no, making your way down to the land of the Geordies and going to Newcastle?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was much tougher than I thought it would be and would have wanted it to be. And that was entirely down to my mental state. I mean, Newcastle's a fantastic city and the university there is just great fun. A lot of cool people, a lot of fun things to do. But for me, I guess a few months before I went to university, I was put on a medication called lithium. And my psychiatrist, I think very sensibly, had tried to see if I could do without medication for a while, because I was only like, at that time, I think I was 18. And ideally, you do not want to be going on medication for the rest of your life when you're 18. particularly not psychiatric medication, because that can be particularly tough. But anyway, I kept getting these kind of mini depressions through after I was left hospital, but before I went to university. And so he said to me, "Look, I've got a feeling that you should maybe try lithium, but if you try it, you might have to be on it for the rest of your life. It's one of these medications that if you come off it, it might not work again." And I was just desperate to be happy. And I'm sure anyone who's been depressed or psychotic knows that when you're in that state, you'd give anything to be happy. It's all about happiness. If someone says, "Do you want to have a great job?" You couldn't give a monkey's. You just want to be happy. You know, someone says you can win the lottery, you don't care, it would make no difference. You just want to be happy. And that's where I was at. So I went on lithium and it worked extremely well for me for about 15 to 20 years. It stopped me from getting seriously depressed. In fact, I would actually say it stopped me from getting depressed, full stop. And it stopped me from getting very manic. I experienced a lot of hypomania when I was on it, but no one really noticed because it was so close to my personality back then that it was kind of fine. You know, I had a lot of fun basically, but it, you know, also had a few problems in having too much fun, and not having any boundaries or whatever. But basically, when I went to university, I was basically trying to come to terms with this new medication, and so I slept a lot. I remember one term, I basically slept the whole term and ate chicken Kievs and chips, and that was it. And because I wasn't on my normal sort of pretty good form self, I didn't make very many friends. I was very lucky to make a very good friend called Mike, who I'm still friends with to this day. He was very kind to me and kind of understood, I think, that I was a bit mad a lot of the time, and was a and is a very stable guy, you know, which is just very nice to kind of have that kind of friendship. But most of my other friendships in that first year were just kind of non-existent. They were with people who I wouldn't have been friends with in any other situation, but I was kind of desperate to have some kind of human contact. And I think to a lot of them, I was pretty mean to them. I was pretty unpredictable. I could be a lot of fun, but I could also be really, really cruel to people with my words. So it was not an easy time, but my saving grace was probably the officer training corps, where I was a part of the sort of pretend army and just had a lot of fun and did a lot of physical stuff.
A lot of what you've just spoken about, I can really relate to in terms of I would see that person, the person that was struggling to get out of bed for a significant period of time, that would only come up, eat, go back to bed. The idea of making friends in your first year, I got very lucky that in the back end of my first year, I made some really good friends from the flat below us in halls, but outside of that, it was like I maybe speak to a couple people occasionally, and I work with one, which I'm very blessed with, but that's very commonplace. It feels like, anyway, for me anyway, that what the experience you had is probably far more common than people would expect. You would then transition from your army work across to working in the financial industry. I think that would be what it would quantify as, but please correct me if I'm wrong. And it would lead to you, although it wouldn't lead to it immediately, it would end up playing a part in the first book you wrote, which is why I'm very intrigued. The first book, I believe it was your first book, The Broker Who Broke Free, Peace Is Found Within. How did you find that process of writing that book? Because something that I noticed, not I haven't read the book yet, and the key word is yet, because I'm highly intrigued by it, but that leaving that work, you would eventually go on this kind of journey to paradise, and you put it in quotations marks, which maybe gives an indication of what that time was like. But how did you find reflecting on such a challenging time as you left that job, but also coming to grips with the reality of like kind of what your actual purpose was down the line?
Yeah, wow, that's quite a question. So I left uni and I started working with some really good mates, just building horse jumps for cross country courses. And it was a really simple job, lots of manual labor, driving a few trucks, you know, digging, moving stones, stuff like that. but I was with two really great friends, and we had just a fantastic time. And ironically, looking back, it's one of the best jobs I ever had. But I guess, like a lot of us, you know, you get into your 20s, and if you're doing a bit of sort of laboring, you maybe think to yourself, gosh, I need to do something a bit more substantial than this if I'm going to have a family, et cetera, et cetera. So I went down to London and I got a job with a bank called Merrill Lynch. And it was my whole aim was to work for 10 years, make as much money as I could, and then buy a place on the beach in Thailand and semi-retire and find peace. That was it. You know, who wouldn't be at peace on a beach in Thailand? Well, probably about 10,000 of your listeners will have been on a beach on Thailand and won't have been at peace. they'll be carrying their heads with them, and they'll be worrying about their work when they get home, or the music's too loud, or the waiter's too rude, or whatever it is. So my whole kind of idea of happiness was kind of flawed, but it's also the idea that most people actually have of happiness. And that's what The Broker Who Broke Free is about. It's in a very sort of simple, humorous way. It's kind of telling the message that the way we've been taught to be happy doesn't work. Because what we've been taught is that if we can get certain things happening in our life, then we'll be happy. And it's different for different people, but for a lot of people, it's the same themes. So for example, if we're a success in our career, we'll be happy. If we win the lottery or have a lot of money, we'll be happy. If we find the perfect relationship, we'll be happy. If we have great health, we'll be happy. A very common one at the moment is that if we travel the world doing what we want, we'll be happy. Now, ironically, all of those things can give us a certain amount of what I call relative happiness. You know, you can feel good for a day or a week or even a month if you're lucky, but it isn't permanent. And if any of those things disappear, or if your relationship changes, or if you invest your money badly, or if you travel to a country where it's actually not so much fun anymore, or you get food poisoning or whatever, all of a sudden that happiness can sink into being unhappy. So it's extremely fragile. So I'm not saying that people shouldn't do any of these things, because it's great to pursue relative happiness. It's a sensible way to live. But what I discovered primarily through meditation and through becoming a monk is that there's this source of true happiness that exists within all of us. And it's an actual experience. It's not an idea of happiness. It's not thinking to yourself, I've got to be positive. I've got to be happy. Everything's okay. Oh, no, this is okay. I've got food poisoning, but I feel great. It's not like that. It's a state of awareness. It's a state of stillness that many of us have experienced before. Perhaps when we're in love, perhaps when we're jumping out of an airplane, perhaps when we're driving a car and we're just relaxed and we're not thinking about anything. We're just driving, we're just present. And what I've discovered over the years is that if I could cultivate a relationship with that stillness and that peace, then I start to become more wise. I start to become more at peace with myself and with the world. There's less conflict in my life. In a strange way, there's less attachment to life. I don't like need life to go my way. And yet there's more enjoyment of life, which is kind of cool. So, but when I got the job at Merrill Lynch, it was all about if I can just make the money, then I'll be happy. So I guess I was fortunate because of bipolar, I was really clear that I wanted to be happy, that this was the most important thing in my life, which again, these days is becoming more and more common. There's been a lot of people saying, well, of course, you know, everyone wants to be happy. But, you know, 25, 30 years ago, actually, the most important thing for most people was to be a success. That was the kind of the thing. And that's why we had programs like Dynasty and Dallas. And it was like these success people, you know. Whereas now, luckily, society's evolved and it is much more about finding happiness and realizing that by being happy, we do make more of a contribution to society, and we do generally make better decisions. Like it's not a selfish thing to do.
Yeah, I oh God, that answer is incredible, and it leads to so many questions I already had planned, and I'm going to go for this one. You've just spoken about being a monk there, and once again, please correct me if I get this pronunciation wrong. You now find yourself as an Ishaya monk?
Yeah, that's awesome. Correct.
Perfect. Can you please explain your early introductions to the Bright Path Ishayas and the benefits you found from that work?
Well, my early introductions, I've written quite a lot about it in The Broker Who Broke Free. because it's very funny and it's quite dramatic. But basically, I eventually gave up my job at Merrill Lynch, having whinged and moaned to my friends and family for about a year and a half, but unable to kind of press the button because the money was so good and the prospects were so good. And I was so, if I'm honest, I was so enamored with being a trader and feeling important and feeling like I was such a success, you know. It was all the, there's a lot of sort of unattractive reasons to stay there, but you know, that's where I was at. So I eventually gave in, and there's a bit of a magic about that because I was about to resign and my father called me and he said, I've just been reading the paper and they're going to offer everyone in your company voluntary redundancy. So don't resign today. So I would have resigned and that would have been
Divine
that. But
timing.
instead, yeah, it's incredible. I would have resigned that day and that would have been that. But instead, I waited a couple of weeks and they paid me to leave.
Dream.
So that was amazing. So I got myself in a situation where I was living in London with one of my best friends in a gorgeous part of Wimbledon. I had lots of money. I had pretty good health at the time. I was playing sport. I was doing all the things that you would sort of tick, you know, had girlfriends and, you know, life was fun for a young guy. And I felt great when I resigned. I felt absolutely great when I resigned. But about 6 weeks later, I felt pretty much the same as I'd done when I was working, but a bit less stressed. And that was a big wake-up call to me because suddenly I was like, oh my goodness, I've given this incredible job up because I wanted to be happy and I'm not happy and I don't know how to be happy and this is a disaster and what do I do? Anyway, fast forward a few weeks, I was getting a shiatsu massage from a guy in Edinburgh and he kept telling me about this thing called the Ashiya's Ascension. Which is a meditation, and just how wonderful it was, and how much peace he had, and all this stuff. And at that time, all I wanted was a shiatsu massage. All I wanted was to be de-stressed. I didn't want to hear about meditation. There's no way I could meditate. I was a trader, for God's sake. My mind was a million miles an hour. No way. And so I very sort of heroically shook his hand at the end, thinking. And he said to me, "Oh, you make sure you look up that meditation, right? You look it up, okay?" And I sort of shook his hand and said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll look it up, thinking inside, no way, no way. And off I went. And funnily enough, just before that happened, about a week before it, I had actually been going for a week for a walk on Wimbledon Common and just listening to Westlife, which I have to say, got a bit of a penchant
Great
for
band.
Westlife. But
Great band. I love Westlife.
yeah, it's just those, you know, those that black and white, turning around black and white, smiling cheesily at the camera. There's sort of the pained loss of love, you know. Oh, I love it.
Have you got a favorite Westlife song? Interject very quickly.
Oh, I think Evergreen or Queen of My Heart. I mean, I think you've got to go cheesy if you're going to do that.
I like Flying Without Wings, so even cheesier.
Oh, that's a belter. That's a belter. Yeah. Well, I think we've now just ruined our musical reputation online. So, yeah,
Yep.
great.
Or enhanced it. It depends on perspective.
I'm hoping enhanced. I'm hoping that time moves on and people get better and better taste.
Sorry for rudely interjecting. You bringing up Westlife, it's like a almost like a trigger of mine. I'm a big fan.
Yeah. They are awesome. Absolutely love
Very
them.
much.
Fantastic. Yeah. So anyway, I'm walking, listening to Westlife in floods of tears, just thinking to myself, I'm screwed. You know, I don't know how to be happy. Nothing's working out. It was an experience of real sort of, I guess you call it youthful disillusionment. And it's the kind of disillusionment that a lot of people are going through at the moment. And I think a lot of people went through in lockdown. And it's this kind of, it's not depression, although, you know, people might call it depression, but it isn't depression because we can still function and we can feed ourselves and kind of get through life. You know, we're not necessarily thinking about sort of killing ourselves or anything, but we are thinking, what's the point? You know, why am I even here? This world's kind of crap. It's I don't even know what I'm meant to do. And so I was sort of thinking this to myself. And then, as I often did when I was in trouble, I would pray to God because I always thought, you know, God's this cool guy in the sky who kind of wants to help me out. That was my view of God, you know. And so I just prayed and I said, look, please help me. Please show me what I'm meant to do with my life because this is a disaster. And it was interesting because for the first time in many years, I think that I became humble. You know, I think in the many years leading up to that, the years of being at school and at university, I think I was quite a know-it-all. I guess like a lot of people are, but I really kind of it wasn't very easy for me to admit. I didn't know, and it's certainly I'd like to give the impression that I was kind of doing the right thing and in control of life. And then suddenly I just life had kind of smacked me down, and I thought I just don't understand this. And it was after that experience that I met the shiatsu guys. So it was actually a bit of kind of divine prominence, or maybe it just came from me being more humble. Because I don't think life really likes to help people who are arrogant, And I think sometimes we can all be arrogant without realizing it, Arrogant isn't necessarily this very obvious thing of just looking down on other people or being dismissive. Arrogance can just be like, I know, I've got this when we haven't, Or it can be an inability or an unwillingness to ask for help, it can be very arrogant too. So I think because I got humble, help kind of arrived in the form of this meditation, but I ignored the shiatsu guy's advice for 4 or 5 months. And in that period, I had four brushes with death. And at the end of the last one, I suddenly realized I need to learn to ascend, or to meditate, as it's called.
And that leads me beautifully into the idea of you then begin this journey with meditation. And I'll be honest, I feel like my experience with meditation could be very similar to a lot of people's, which is I always enjoy it when I do it. I do it for about 10 days and then I just stop. No reason. I know it's good. I know it takes like 10 minutes. It takes minimal effort. It can really reframe the day or mood that you're in, and I just don't do it for no good reason anyway. But or I guess in some cases people would convince themselves, oh, they're too tired, they're too busy, da 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 da. But I know for a fact I just don't have a good reason. So can you explain your initial kind of experiences with meditation, like what it gave you very early on, and kind of the importance it's played in your life from those early days all the way to, I imagine now, in terms of it playing still a big part in terms of you managing your mental and emotional well-being.
Yeah, I can do that. Well, when I learned to meditate, I was so far away from the kind of the spiritual movement. And in those days, it was very much the New Age movement. There are a lot of women with purple hair and crystals, and a lot of very, very feminine guys kind of talking about chakras and healing and stuff. And so I was kind of dropped in this very sensitive arena, and I was like ex-public school trader, completely insensitive, always just want to have a laugh, tease people, be rude, saying totally inappropriate things, the kind of things that nowadays I'd have been cancelled 100 times over for. And that was me. And I think fortunately I was a genuinely a nice bloke, and I was doing my best, and I could be quite sort of charming, so I got away with it in the most part. But basically, I found myself in this environment with people who were really different to me, but who wanted peace. And I found that desire very unifying, actually. I thought that's really cool. I've never met someone before who actually openly admits that they want peace. And at that time, I didn't even know what peace was. My mind, it's a bipolar mind. I imagine it's more intense than most. And although I could relate to joy and happiness, I could not relate to peace. I can't ever remember experiencing peace before, although I'm sure I did as a young kid. So my first experiences of ascension was that I liked the people who were there. I thought, these are nice people. That's a really good sign. These are good people. And the monks told me that if I did it, I would experience more peace and joy, and life would become easier. And at that time, that sounded amazing, particularly the easier life thing, because I was struggling. But most people, when they learn to ascend, and I've been teaching it now for almost 20 years, most people, when they learn, they experience a lot of peace on the first weekend. Like, and it's really obvious. Like, you're talking about your meditation. It's really obvious. Oh, this is good for me. Oh, this is a nice rest, I didn't. I've since discovered that because of lithium, it was very hard for me to experience kind of nice feelings. It kind of, in many ways, it shut my emotions down for a long time when I was on a relatively high dose, which I was back then. And so I thought it was incredibly boring to close my eyes and meditate. I was so bored, and I used to just pray to fall asleep. And whenever I felt asleep, I thought, this is great, you know? But luckily, I trusted the monks, and I kept doing it. And my life with my eyes open started to get better and better. And so in the first weekend, I had a cool experience because I went for a walk on Glastonbury tour, because Glastonbury was where I learned. Now, Glastonbury is an incredible place. I just love that place. And you can't get there by train. You have to get to a place called Castle Carey, because it's kind of, in some way, it's almost like protected, you know, from civilization. And I went, and I was in Glastonbury, and before I'd sort of started to ascend and to meditate, I never really noticed nature. I wasn't tuned into it. A tree was a tree. A field was a field. Who cares? Didn't really notice beauty, whatever. But after doing it for a couple of days, I suddenly noticed this beautiful tree and how gorgeous the bark was and how old and almost sacred it was. And I had this cool experience of looking out over Glastonbury from the tour and just seeing all the higgledy-piggledy houses and the fields and just thinking, wow, it's so beautiful. And the place that I was at, I'd almost never have admitted that to anyone. You don't talk about beauty when you're a young guy, you know, you don't, whatever. Again, things have changed, thank goodness. But that excited me because that was a genuine experience. And then I also noticed that my relationship started getting easier and richer. I started becoming a nicer person. I started to develop more patience. It was kind when you said how patient I was, because that's one of the things that's really developed from ascending for me is patience. So loads and loads of cool things happened. And that's that.
My mind goes to you then getting into the creative process of writing potentially your third book, but please correct me if I'm wrong, but Befriending Bipolar, which I love, by the way. And I think, actually, before I speak about the creative process, I actually want to just say, I love the concept of Befriending Bipolar, and I say that as a book title and a concept in general, just an ideology, because it's the idea of, and I would like for you to speak about it, because I've got a funny feeling it was potentially intentional in one way because of this, which is that rather than it being your identity and the kind of I am bipolar, it being a core part of who you are, it's something that you manage. It's external to who you are as Ollie. That it isn't that Ollie is bipolar. It's Ollie has bipolar. It's something that you have. It's not who you are. And I think whether intentional or unintentional, kind of befriending bipolar, it's immediately detaching the idea of it being who you are. And it's actually just a thing that you have and manage. So I love the concept, and I wanted to ask you, is that like a part of your process, the idea of removing it as a part of your identity of who you are and kind of maybe taking less of the power of it, less of the potency of it, that you're actually Ollie Seligman and that you have bipolar rather than it being kind of intertwined in who you are?
Yeah, that's bang on. That's absolutely bang on. What I've seen over the years, and it took me many years to see this, is that when something big happens to someone in their life, it's really easy to identify with it very strongly. And it's also relatively easy to completely deny it. And that probably the healthiest approach is somewhere in the middle. But that's a journey that people have to make for themselves. And for me, it's interesting because when I was first diagnosed with bipolar, I just wanted to put it behind me and get on with my life. And the idea of getting ill again was terrifying to me, because I'd suffered more than I ever imagined possible. And I just did not want to go there. Now, obviously, a sensible approach would have been to start to educate myself, maybe join some groups, maybe get some kind of long-term therapy or whatever. But that wasn't part of the equation then. And I don't regret that, because it didn't happen. But a few years later, I did start investigating it and I did start learning more about it. And it was mainly when I was writing Befriending Bipolar, and I felt this incredible relief and joy around the whole thing. And I got the opportunity to really begin to understand what had happened to me through writing. And I got to hear other people's experiences and talk to a lot of people with bipolar and depression and see what they'd been through. And there were so many things that were similar, you know, as you've been talking about, Luca. which gave me an incredible feeling of security and kind of almost friendliness to the whole situation. And fairly quickly, I managed to just let go of a lot of the bitterness that I'd been carrying. And a lot of my bitterness was directed towards people who I felt had let me down. Now, some of them had let me down, but a lot of them, I just had too high expectations of them as well. You know, so it was this balance. It's interesting, when one writes a book like Befriending Bipolar, one really has to take ownership of what's going on. Like, it's not cool to write a book where you're blaming a load of other people for stuff. It's just not cool. And it doesn't indicate that the author has actually come to terms with what's happening and is even worth really listening to. And so I had to go through a few sessions where I would write a chapter where I was really angry. And then once I kind of written it, it was almost like I got off my chest, and then I could write the proper chapter, you know, where I was a bit more grown up and a bit more owning a little bit more of what was going on, you know? So that was cool. That was cool for me. But I just think in general, I think that the whole befriending it, when I was younger, from puberty, I became a sort of a fighter rather than a lover. And I was tiny. It was ridiculous, me being a fighter, because I wasn't in any state to fight anyone. But inside, I was a fighter. I fought and fought and fought. And then over time, and doing meditation and getting therapy and stuff, I became more of a lover, more of a just, you know, an accepting more. And I saw the difference in power, the difference between power and force. And fighting something can be forceful. It can be very helpful to people. Like, there are a lot of people, they talk about fighting cancer, or they talk about fighting mental illness. Now, if that's an approach that they found that's worked for them, then I commend them for it. Nothing wrong with that at all. That's cool. But what I found was that when I had the choice between fighting and accepting is much harder to do than fighting, because it really involves some home truths and giving up the dreams that we had of how we thought our life would be, and yet not being resentful. But I found that by accepting it, it's made a massive difference, because I can now joke about it. I can laugh about it. I'm not precious about being mentally ill. I'm very happy to talk openly and honestly with people about it. You know, I don't feel I'm guarding anything anymore. If there are certain things I don't want to talk about, I'm quite happy to say, I don't want to talk about that. But that in itself is a kind of an honesty, you know, that I didn't have when I was denying it and fighting it. When I was denying it and fighting it, it was like, I did not want this thing in my life. And I wasn't even going to admit that. I was just, what I was going to tell people was, I've overcome this really hard, really tough illness. I'm stronger and braver than anyone else I know. God, look at me. I'm great. Just leave me alone. Don't talk to me. I'm going to get on with this. And so that's why I chose Befriending Bipolar, because I think if one can befriend any challenge in our lives, then the opportunity to solve it or to live with it better is far greater.
Yeah, and it's an incredible, it's an incredibly relatable message, right? Because we all have a form of battle that we battle with. So if you can change even the verbiage I've used there is indicative of literally just what you've said, the idea of battling, the idea of, if you can change that to accepting, yeah, you can just approach it from such a nicer energy. And yeah, I love that answer so much. My mind goes to the creative process again, the idea of, this is a really potentially ignorant question in terms of, more so a dumb question, even though they say there's no such thing as a dumb question, but the idea of, as you've said already, like finding the dosages right for your medication, I was curious as to how do you strike the balance of being creative and allowing your mind to dream these big things with your books, with the direction you want to take it, whilst also having medication, which is naturally designed to kind of even you out and stop you going to these kind of places, I guess, of fantasy / just allowing your mind to wander, whereas the medication itself is already trying to bring you more back into the reality. Like, how have you found striking that balance of allowing yourself to be creative and expressive whilst also having your medication that keeps you in a safe space in that sense?
I've never been asked that before. That's an amazing question. Well, when I was on the sort of the initial dose of lithium that I was on for 20 years, which I think was 1,000 milligrams a day, I didn't do anything creative in that time. I gave up art. I was quite good at art and drawing and stuff, and I stopped that. And I didn't write any books. I think I started to write a book, which I wrote for a couple of weeks, and then I just gave up because I couldn't. It's like I didn't have access to creativity. One of the interesting things about creativity is that a lot of people who are creative, they recognize that they don't really create themselves. They're just there and the creativity comes through them. It's almost like a gift. And I felt that lithium closed that door. So there was no room to be creative. So instead of sort of being creative or, doing other things to kind of get my kicks and have my fun, I became addicted to fun and just chasing pleasure however I could. But after a period of time, I think it was after about 15, 20 years, I started coming off lithium. And as soon as I got onto lower doses of it, I could write again and I could draw again. I've actually did one drawing that I was really, really proud of, actually, when I was doing it. It just came out of nowhere. And The Broke Who Broke Free, that was written when I was coming off lithium. And Befriending Bipolar was written when I was back on lithium, but on a lower dose that allows me to be more creative. So I've had to accept or befriend the fact that I won't have access to the creativity that I would have if I wasn't on medication. But if you can't change it, you kind of got to accept it. And so I feel I've accepted it. I'm not bitter.
Yeah, it's just I think of a lot of like really creative people and you learn about like the mental battles that they have, and it's almost like the ideology of how like the mind can be such a great it can be such a great gift, but you're almost a servant to it at times. And
Yeah.
yeah, it was something that really intrigued me, the fact that you've got on these creative endeavors whilst knowing that the medication that you have taken is kind of keeping you in a safe space at the same time, but maybe counterintuitive to you being creative. So yeah, it crossed my mind, but that's a fantastic answer. And I'm happy you haven't been asked it before and you enjoyed the
Yeah.
question, because I wrote it down and I was like, I really want to ask it because I'm a little bit nerdy in that sense, but
Yeah.
I was like, this could be a really stupid fucking question, but I'm happy you enjoyed it.
That's cool. I can give you some pretty trippy answers to some other stuff if you want that you probably won't have had before.
Which I'm, by the way, you can already tell that's something I'm very, very much here for. So I'm very appreciative of it. Now I want to go into how have you found the feedback from Befriending Bipolar, from whether it's people that are in the bipolar community or people that are external to it, but maybe have a loved one or a friend or someone that it's drawn them to your book. Or it might just be a friend or loved one of yours that just wanted to support and kind of read what you'd produce. So, how have you found the feedback from the book itself in the people in the community and outside of it?
The feedback's been amazing. I think I've got the book's been out for a year and I've got over 90 reviews on Amazon, and I think like 88 of them are 5-star or whatever. Like, it's amazing. And the things that people write is very touching. It seems that by reading the book, a lot of people, if they have bipolar, they start to feel better about it and they can relate to many of my stories. And it's almost like it somehow reinforces something positive in them. And a lot of friends and family have just really enjoyed the fact that they have more chance to understand a bit of what's going on for their loved one or their friend or whatever. I've had some feedback from psychologists and psychiatrists as well, which is great. And they generally seem to think it's just a really good book. And a couple have even said that it should be on sort of medical, university medical school syllabuses and things like that. Because the way I've written it is that, I mean, it's a fun, interesting book. There's some really intense stories in there, and there's some real, it's wild, the things that I've been through. But also there's a lot of reflection and a lot of sort of, I would say, maturity. And at the end of each chapter, I have like a summary so that particularly doctors can just, they don't have to read the whole book. They can just read the summary to see the main points. And a lot of what I write about is like my sort of personal experiences with bipolar and what would have made it better? Like, how can mental hospitals do things better? How can doctors interact in a way that's easier for everyone? I talk a lot about love and the importance of love in mental health, which hasn't been talked about a lot. And yet love is like the most important driving force in the world. Some would say fear, I would say love, but some would say fear. But and yet it's not talked about with mental health, you know? So there's a lot in the book that I think is quite original. And yeah, people have, I've been blown away. I had no idea it would have the impact that it's had. And yeah, I just hope it keeps spreading and selling. I'm just loving it.
Well, I'm glad it's been received positively. And I am going to read it. I'm going to say it. I'm going to speak into the universe. I'm terrible in terms of reading, but I want to. So I promise I will read it.
I'll send you a copy and The Broke Who Broke Free.
No, you don't need to send a copy. I promise.
I will.
So Ollie, this is something that has been fairly new for me. I did it by accident at the end of season 4, but I've almost introduced a mini segment in these episodes. Still haven't got a fancy name for it. Kind of my head's nearly there. I can feel it. The name for it's coming. But what it is I'm going to say a bunch of really nice things that I've prepared properly in terms of me learning about your story with a question at the end. But it allows me to, in the moment, because I think something I haven't been able to do in the moment in these interviews is to kind of voice my respect and admiration for the people that I'm speaking to. So it's kind of like a gift / whatever you feel, but because I think if I was to be complimented, I maybe wouldn't know how to react, but I'm going to go. So this is what I prepared for you. You've not only been on this journey of your mental well-being over the years, but you've also found the strength, resourcefulness, and purpose to help other people with their own experiences with bipolar disorder. I'll always have a soft spot for any man that goes about their work by adding to the conversation of men's mental health. It's actually something I'm really, really, really have a soft spot for. And I've developed an incredible amount of respect for the work that you're doing. I'm in awe of the man that you are now after learning about the battles that you fought / befriended, and where you are now. I believe that you should be incredibly proud of the man that you are, and I'm grateful that we've shared this conversation. You've spoken about that you don't feel that you've overcame bipolar. Do you allow yourself to still feel a sense of achievement with what you have overcame to where you are today?
Yeah, I do. I'm not one of these kind of so anal people who wouldn't let any of the love in and wouldn't take any credit for anything. Like, I think it's cool to take credit for the things that I think I deserve credit for. And I would definitely take credit for the way I've handled bipolar, particularly in the last few years. Yeah, I think that's fair play. Thank you.
No problem. That's okay. You've made the decision with your experience with bipolar, a mental health-based issue, to be like open and transparent is something that I greatly respect, because I think it's something that I've had trouble with in the past in terms of being open about my mental health battles. And can you speak to the power of being open about your story in terms of what that can give people that you've maybe heard or not heard from feedback? But can you just speak to the power of being open about the battles that you've overcame / befriended / continue to befriend?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the best way to touch other people is to be honest and to have a sense of humor. I don't think there are many people in this world who've been through a lot who don't have a good sense of humor. I think there are a lot of people who've been through very little who take life very, very seriously and get very offended by everything that seems to happen. And I think for those guys, they really need to grow up, because there's a lot of people in the world who've been through some serious shit, and they're able to laugh about it and they're able to share about it. And in that way, it's like they help other people. Like, I'm a great believer in a thing called an attractor field, which was put forward by a guy called Dr. David Hawkins, who's a psychiatrist in America. Amazing guy, very, very happy, wonderful man. And he talked about that if someone has been through a great challenge, whatever that challenge is, it could be a really, really bad divorce. It could be physical disability. It could be being blind. It could be being seriously dyslexic when all you want to do is be a writer. Whatever it is, it's like it's serious as far as your kind of life is concerned. And if you get to a place where you accept that, like genuinely accept it, like this is life. I've got to just accept this. I can't change it. I can maybe do things to improve it a bit, but basically this is where my life is. Then you create a healing energy within your aura that then affects other people who you talk to about it, if they have the same thing or if they have a similar thing. And it's almost like humanity is completely intrinsically connected within this stillness. You know, we're not separate individuals battling our way in life, although it can sometimes feel like that. We are absolutely connected and part of this stillness. And when one part of that stillness accepts something or makes a decision that's kind or good or uplifting, then it does affect the rest of it. And it does affect the people around us. And so sort of going back to your question, I feel very blessed that what I've been through, I'm now able to do good with it. Would I go back and go through it again so I could do good? Probably not. I think I'd be lying if I said it was too horrible. But the fact is I have been through it, and lots of you guys have been through stuff. And the question is like, well, what am I going to do with that? Because we've kind of really only got two questions. We can either become bitter and twisted about it, and that ruins everything for everyone, or we can do our best to learn to accept it and work with it and to somehow serve other people with it, which, funnily enough, will generally improve our life too. And so I'm a great believer in doing my best to help without being a martyr, you know, and without making like a massive deal about it, but also enjoying it. You know, it's wonderful to help other people. It's great, you know, look at this podcast, you know. But yeah, that's what I think.
I love it. So, Ollie, before I ask you the final four questions, I want to give you a time to shamelessly plug anything you've got going on, any way that people can engage with you. So whether it's trying to find more of you on social media, any projects that you've got going on, anywhere to go buy the books, Ollie, please shamelessly plug everything you've got going on.
Well, that's kind. I guess I'm only going to plug a couple of things, but my YouTube channel is called Befriending Bipolar. So if you type that into YouTube, or if you type my name, Oliver Seligman, then you can find it. And if you like what's there, then please subscribe. That's fun. I'm trying to build it up. You can find my books on Amazon. If you just type in Oliver Seligman, you'll get them. And I also actually would like to ask for help, because I would really like to find a really good publisher and get like a good publishing deal for Befriending Bipolar and The Broke Who Broke Free. Both are self-published. And so I am looking for someone to help me get it out there. So if anyone knows anyone, I'd be grateful if they could get in touch with me. My email is oliverseligman@gmail.com.
Perfect. Everything that Ollie's just mentioned lives in the show notes, so please check that out. So, Ollie, you'll know this. So, final four questions, they're questions that I ask everyone. I've made one change to them potentially since you've seen them. So, there is one which is a visualization, which you will find out shortly. But the first one is one I've asked before. So, number one, if I was to give you a megaphone that spoke to the entire world and you could share only one message, what would it be?
Find peace.
Love it. That's awesome. Number two. What are three personality traits / characteristics that you would say you've built your life upon up to this point?
Humor, friendliness, and bravery.
Oh, that's a great one. I love that. This is the new one. So number three, you can close your eyes if that you think they will help, but it's a visualization. So you walk into a room and you see a table with two chairs, one of which someone is already sitting in. As you walk closer to the table, you begin to realize that the person that is seated there is an 18-year-old version of yourself. You take the other seat and you're informed from a random voice that you can tell your 18-year-old self one message before they go back to their everyday life. What would you want to tell them, And how do you think it would impact them hearing that from your current version of yourself?
I would say it's all going to work out. Love people as best as you can.
Awesome. Such a great answer. The final question, my favorite question. Many years into the future, your time as Ollie Seligman is coming to an end. The person closest to you only has one sentence to describe you and your time here on Earth. What would you hope that would be?
It would be, he was a good bloke.
I'm fairly certain that they will say that. Ollie, thank you so much. I mean, whether it's my poor communication in the build-up, whether it's my laptop just going mental at the beginning of the first recording. Once again, patience and just a sense of ease, I think, is something that is really evident in kind of the way you carry yourself, and it's something I'm greatly appreciative of. So thank you so much.
Well, this has been an amazing interview. You ask questions so well. You give so much space to me. I've never opened up like this on an interview, and it's because you've given me so much space to do it. I don't feel rushed or anything. Amazing. Thank you. And you've obviously got a big heart. That's very apparent.
Thank you so much. Once again, people, please check the show notes out. Please check out everything that Ollie's got going on. It's incredible, the work he's doing. So please check it out. All right, everyone. Goodbye.